COVID goes from 0 to 60 miles per hour very quickly. We're in a place today, but that can rapidly change. Maybe not statewide, maybe just in a handful of counties, but further restrictions is what we hope to avoid.
California Health and Human Services Secretary Dr. Mark Galli during a news conference yesterday, after the governor announced a mandatory overnight stay-at-home order for most of the state from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. for the next month. L.A. County reported more than 5,000 new cases yesterday. That's a record. And if that number doesn't improve over the next few days, there could be even more restrictions. We're going to talk about this now with L.A. County Supervisor Janice Hahn. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be on your show.
Good to have you. Well, what do you make of these new numbers? 5,000 new cases yesterday, 1,200 people hospitalized?
To be honest with you, I am completely taken aback by this surge this week. I think on Tuesday, we were at 2,300 cases. Then Wednesday, we shot up to 39. But now to already be over 5,000 cases is really shocking to me. And I'm worried, to be honest with you. It's a very dire situation. And what we all are worried about is that, well, certainly we don't want people infected. We certainly don't want more people dying from this virus. But we're worried about our hospitals becoming overwhelmed, and our frontline doctors and nurses and hospital staff to also be overwhelmed. So I'm worried, honestly, and I'm shocked it surged so quickly this week.
Yeah, I think we all are. It is really gobsmacking. I'm wondering, because there are certain rules in place, if the number of cases continues to rise or stay at this really high level, that I'm wondering what happens next in terms of going back to a stay-at-home order. Isn't there a red line of number of cases over a five-day period that the county looks at before they say, okay, we've got to shut everything down?
So we laid out a plan on Tuesday, and we said that if we reached 3,500 cases a day, we would start implementing a lower capacity of diners at restaurants and a curfew on businesses from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. Well, that's already happened. Then we said if we hit 5 days of 4,000 cases, we're going to move to only allow restaurants to operate for takeout and delivery. And then if we reach a 4,500 average over 5 days, we're ready to trigger a three-week safer at home order. What's shocking to me is that on Tuesday, when the Board of Supervisors said, let's get ahead of this, let's not even wait till 3,500, let's go ahead and tell restaurants, let's limit your capacity. Let's stop people from gathering at restaurants and bars after 10 p.m. And we already hit the 3,500 case. We're already over the 4,000. And I heard Dr. Farrar think that we might already be at the 4,500 case by, you know, either this weekend or Monday or Tuesday. So it's moving quickly. Mm-hmm. We did give people a little more warning this time about what would happen. So hopefully the public is looking at these numbers and are, you know, putting two and two together to understand where we're headed in L.A. County.
Right. But it's probably safe to say that if people are infected and those numbers are going to be high over the next few days, they're already infected. They're not. The actions that they take now to prevent infection would prevent, you know, the numbers further down the line. So if by Sunday we have reached this rolling average of 4,500, what happens?
Then we're going to trigger the three-week safer at home order. And if people remember it, it seems like a long time ago when we started April and May, we did this. And if, you know, you remember, we told people, look, you're safer at home. So just think about that. Anytime you're thinking about going out for something, you're safer at home. So you can go out and get groceries, but come right back home. If you have to go to the pharmacy to get your medicine, come back home. I think people have really become a little lax in their, you know, their diligence about being safe, because everyone's, you know, COVID fatigued. I know I am.
Yeah.
But we have to remember what it was like when there was very few cars on the street. It almost seemed a little eerie that people weren't out and about. And we're looking to go back to that, you know, before maybe next week, all the way through the end of the year. And it's unfortunate because I think people thought we were learning to live with this virus and, you know, putting safety protocols in place. But these numbers don't indicate that we have got it under control at all.
So that means, for example, restaurants would only be open for takeout or delivery. They would be closed for outdoor dining.
Yes.
All non-essential businesses would be shut.
Correct. Correct.
All retail, that's non-essential.
I think so. I think that's what we're looking at. And, you know, we, again, we did that early on and we felt like things were under control. So we started listening to the business community and the retailers saying, you've got to throw us a, you know, a lifeline here. We're drowning. So we began to eke out, you know, outside dining and allowing, you know, indoor malls to reopen and, you know, letting small businesses reopen. Cause we felt like, you know, we were losing jobs. We were killing our economy, but in retrospect, you know, that might have given them a brief lifeline to their businesses. But here we are right back where we started.
And here we are also during the holiday season where retailers really need the cash infusion. I mean, they're already on the lifeline, as you say. And so they were probably hoping that the holidays would carry them through. And now they might be shut down again.
Yes. You know, and I'm hoping, I think some of the businesses that figured out how to pivot and reinvent themselves might survive. I think a lot of businesses didn't even have, an online shopping, you know, website. Mm-hmm. And I think they've had to reinvent themselves. And I think if we can go back to encouraging people to shop online, so they're still, getting what they need, plus, allowing these businesses to remain open will work. But it's very tough, which is also why, you know, we should all just be, you know, screaming and hollering to Washington, D.C. We need some help here. We need to be able to pay people to stay home. If we really want to get this under control before the vaccine comes, we need to make it okay for people not to work right now or not to have their businesses open. But they need some kind of a lifeline from the federal government. And it's disheartening to me that there is not a second or, you know, a coronavirus CARES Act coming our way. We need help. People need to stay home. People need to be safe, but they need an income. And they need to be able to support their families through this. And I don't understand why that's still in logjam.
Well, it doesn't look like it's going to be unstuck until there's a new Congress at the very earliest. That would be January, right? So how does the county, function until then?
You know, we're digging deep into our own coffers and we're providing another round of grants to our small businesses. We're offering $5 million pool of grants to childcare facilities because we know there are certain parents that don't have the luxury of working from home and they have to go to work, but they found it very difficult and financially sometimes unaffordable for childcare. So we're going to get some money straight to these childcare facilities so that they'll be able to, you know, offer vouchers to parents who need it. So we in the county are continually to give out money to small businesses, to nonprofits, to childcare facilities so that, you know, some people can survive.
I wonder if you're rethinking the school closures here in LA County, because there is a scientific evidence now that the virus is not as easily spread from small children and that schools are actually safer than many other places that were allowed to stay open, like restaurants and bars, and that there's real damage being done to children now with this whole, now it's going to be probably a year of learning loss. Is the county, are you considering doing anything to open schools back up more quickly?
Well, Madeline, I'm glad you brought that up because honestly, everything for me anyway is about getting kids back to school, which is why it's been a very difficult balance making efforts to open, you know, restaurants and breweries and casinos while we know the real goal is to get kids back to school. So right now in LA County, any elementary school in LA County can allow their TK through second grade right now to come back to campus. Then we're also offering every school, elementary school, the ability to bring other students back on campus who are those that really need in-person learning. They might have special needs, they might have disabilities, they might be English learners. But we all know those kids who really aren't doing well at home online. And we're also allowing those to come back. So there's quite a number of students that can come back right now on campus. But the goal is, and maybe by January, new semester, we're going to be able to then bring all kids through sixth grade back on campus. But, you know, we always had the caveat, unless there was a safer at home order, you know, happening. And when we were making these plans, none of us believed that that would be a reality, that by January, oh, we'll be able to bring kids back. But now looking at the possibility of a safer at home order here in LA County, then that makes the whole coming back to school more complicated. But I do worry about our kids. There's so much they're losing in terms of social interaction with friends. And now we're all going to sort of lose our traditional sense of what Thanksgiving is. We may be losing, you know, the holidays in December. So it's a year that we're sacrificing. And I guess my message is we just all just have to just buckle down. There are going to be some sacrifices and just hope, you know, that 2021 will be a brighter year for all of us with the introduction of a vaccine.
Yeah, and that's a whole other can of worms, which we can't get into right now, how that's going to be distributed. But hopefully we can have you back to talk about that. LA County Supervisor Janice Hahn, thank you so much.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, meanwhile, the White House is obsessed with overturning the presidential election. We'll have the latest on how the Trump team is really failing at doing that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
I think they're witnessing incredible irresponsibility, incredibly damaging messages being sent to the rest of the world about how democracy functions. And I think it is, I don't know his motive, but I just think it's totally irresponsible.
President-elect Joe Biden yesterday on President Trump's ongoing campaign to overturn the election. Trump's strategy has shifted recently after losing nearly all of his legal challenges. He is now pressuring officials in battleground states to not certify the election results. And that's just the beginning of what has been a bizarre and unprecedented week in presidential election history. We're going to talk about this now with Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hey, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, it's one thing to go through the courts and try to exhaust your legal avenues, but it's quite another thing to pressure state officials to overturn the vote. Is this essentially a coup attempt?
Well, I think exhaust is certainly the key word there. They have been going through the courts in a number of cases in these key states and have been met almost completely with the resistance of judges who have found their arguments to be not compelling or lacking substantiation. In some cases, there have been situations in which the judges actually rebuked the lawyers for what they were saying. And it should be noted that even the arguments that these lawyers are putting forward are not the same things that the president is saying. They are not saying that this is fraud. They are, in a lot of cases, not saying the same things the president is saying about voting machines and various other issues like dead people voting. So I think that the president moving to a strategy in which he's seemingly asking state legislatures to stand in the way of these votes being certified was maybe a predictable next step in this whole thing. But you're right that this is a very drastic thing, even more undemocratic than we saw with these lawsuits, and certainly raises questions about, you know, the Trump campaign saying their goal is to count all legal votes. Well, when you do something like this, you are casting aside a vast majority of legal votes, even if you concede that there is some measure of voter fraud in any American election.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Michigan in particular. Joe Biden won pretty handily there. He's up by nearly 160,000 votes in that state. And the president has invited the members of the legislature, the Republican members of the legislature, it's a Republican-controlled state legislature there in Michigan, to the White House. For what purpose?
Well, the White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany said today that this was not about leaning on the legislators to actually do something related to the election. Certainly, it suggests pretty clearly what's afoot here, which is an effort to maybe not necessarily convince them right away to do the things that he wants them to, but to maybe take this step eventually, or at least raise concerns about what they might do as far as validating Joe Biden's win in that state.
So that could actually, that is a plausible path that the legislature could reject the findings that Joe Biden won in Michigan. Then what would happen?
Well, basically, it's a speculative and fraught theory about how to overturn the results in that state. Mm-hmm. Were the state legislature to send a different slate of electors than the certification process, the Congress would basically have to decide between which groups of electors it wants to recognize. Of course, we have a split Congress. The Democrats hold the House. And ultimately, when it comes down to it, if there is a dispute that cannot be settled, it would be up to the governor in the state to basically decide which slate of electors applies here. And of course, in these key states, in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, we do have Democratic governors who would then be in the position to do that. So ultimately, I'm not sure that this would succeed, but there are so many moving parts here that it seems to be at least the strategy of last resort for the Trump campaign in hopes that it might throw things into some kind of disarray and maybe ultimately get to the result that they want.
Okay, let's look at Georgia. Today, that vote was certified after a hand recount, and the Republican Secretary of State is refusing to talk to Trump's team. He says he won't take any phone calls from them. The governor, Brian Kemp, who's a Republican, is not challenging the results, which were in Biden's favor. So is that the end of that in Georgia?
Well, it's going to be a matter of litigation now. We've seen early in this process the litigation more focused on states like Pennsylvania, like Wisconsin, like Michigan, where there are some earlier deadlines for certification and where the process moved along more quickly. In Georgia, it was really put on hold for a little while because we did have the prospect of a hand recount, which has now been completed. And so the Trump campaign has now filed a suit in Georgia, rather. So they are going to be pressing forward there. It's one of the most closely divided states. But we did see from the recount that the result didn't actually shift all that significantly. There were some votes that were found later on in some Republican-leaning areas. And so it's really incumbent upon the Trump campaign to actually find some kind of voter fraud there. And as you mentioned, the Secretary of State there, Brad Raffensperger, the Republican Secretary of State, has been adamant that there is no substantiation to these claims so far, and that he hasn't seen anything that would cause him to question the fact that Joe Biden has won that state. And so certainly a very, what maybe the most interesting figure in all of this has been Brad Raffensperger and his willingness to basically call things like he sees them and even accuse Republicans like Lindsey Graham of essentially leaning on him to try and kind of rig the vote totals.
Interesting. Okay, another interesting figure is Christopher Krebs, the Department of Homeland Security official, who was fired by President Trump, basically for saying that the election was free and fair. And he tweeted yesterday about this news conference that Rudy Giuliani headlined at the RNC. He said it was the most dangerous 1 hour, 45 minutes of TV in American history, and possibly the craziest.
Yeah, so I think Chris Krebs, he was a member of the Trump administration. He's a top official in the Department of Homeland Security who was essentially running a live fact-checking rumor control website and tweeting about various theories that were promoted by the president, calling them baseless, including the allegations about voting machines. And I think that his take on the press conference yesterday very much reflected the rumor control work that he'd been doing. He'd been talking about many of the things that came up at that press conference. And I don't think there's any disputing the fact that the theories that were espoused at that press conference went significantly beyond anything we'd seen from the Trump campaign so far. It makes you wonder how much of this is truly a legal strategy at this point and how much it's really a public relations strategy meant to convince Republicans to stick with the team.
But I mean, Republicans privately, are they scratching their heads and thinking, what's happening with all this? I mean, just the optics alone of Rudy Giuliani up there talking about conspiracy theories involving Venezuela and, you know, all sorts of, as you said, disproven, factually incorrect statements while he's sweating and hair dye is running down his face and quoting from My Cousin Vinny to, as a legal argument. I mean, what are Republicans thinking about all this?
Well, I will say that the My Cousin Vinny thing was maybe my favorite part of the news conference on Thursday. But,
well, it is humorous. But, I will say that.
Yeah, well, I mean, among the many points that he was making, it might have been one of the more valid ones, perhaps, because it was about observers not being allowed to get close enough to actually see things or something like that. So, but I think the real point is that we're dealing with a situation in which the theories are becoming more far-flung. We saw today there was a there was a claim in the news conference in which they referenced the idea that certain precincts had overvoted by as much as 350%. We're learning today that that's not actually the case and that the affidavit they were citing actually refers to data not in Michigan, which they said it was, but in Minnesota. So it really seems to be a very haphazard effort here. Many of the claims are just being thrown against the wall in hopes that maybe one of them will stick and convince people that there's enough voter fraud to throw this thing into some kind of doubt in people's minds.
Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, after we taped that interview with Aaron this morning, the Georgia Secretary of State issued a correction saying the state had not yet certified the election for Biden, but that it would finish soon. A news conference is scheduled for later this afternoon where the state's Republican governor and the Secretary of State are expected to officially certify the election then. Okay. Coming up, lots of reasons on your screen to stay home this weekend.
This is actually, I would say, a bit of an inside joke with Star Wars fans as well, because it washes the horrible taste out of their mouths of the 1978 Star Wars special.
We will have your Friday film reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time to escape our crumbling universe by diving into the cinematic universe. Joining me now is Christy Lemire. She writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Welcome back, Christy.
Hello, Madeline.
And Jacqueline Coley is here. She's editor for Rotten Tomatoes and co-host of the new podcast, Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. Welcome back to you, Jacqueline.
Hey, Madeline. Glad to be back.
Glad to have you. Let's begin with Sound of Metal from director Darius Marder. It's about a heavy metal drummer who loses his hearing. And here's a clip from the trailer.
Your hearing is deteriorating rapidly.
Lou, no. Let's play them all and see what it's like, okay? I'm gonna be like a click track. You can play to me.
I can't hear you. Do you understand me? I can't. I'm deaf.
I found a place.
I think it's important that you stay here with us right now, Reuben. We're looking for a solution to this.
So, Christy, this sounds unusual and intriguing, is it?
I love this movie so much. It is unusual and it's intriguing. It does so much that is so difficult so well, beginning with Riz Ahmed's performance. He plays this heavy metal drummer. He and his girlfriend, played by Olivia Cooke, have like a two-person band, and they're just playing random gigs all over the country. They live out of their big RV. And they have a nice little groove that they're in. And then he realizes one day that he's losing his hearing. And then it happens really rapidly. And then all of a sudden he is deaf. And what is fascinating about this, his performance is so visceral and so raw. But also the sound design is really innovative. And so Darius Marder will put you inside of his head to experience the gradations in hearing that he has and how it is, you know, muffled and deteriorating. And you can feel his panic. You can feel his frustration because it's like you're inside of his head. But also the whole movie has closed captioning to make it accessible to hearing impaired viewers. And so that's really cool too. And it's just the journey that he goes on. Part of what's interesting about it too is that his character is a recovering heroin addict. And so how does he not relapse because of this major shift in his life and how scary things are for him? Paul Racy, who is hearing impaired, plays a huge role, and he's fantastic in it. He's hugely charismatic in it and helping teach Riz Ahmed's character sign language and giving him a home. So I really loved it. It's a really fascinating and very specific and intimate story.
Jacqueline?
I have to agree with Christy, particularly about the sound design. This is the type of film that in a normal year, when you're going to be having, you know, Transformers style sound design and these big blockbusters, this one might have a hard time sort of breaking through. But honestly, I think it is a front runner for the sound design, in particular in the Oscar race. And it's just a really compelling film. And I also want to say that Olivia Cooke, I want to make sure I'm saying her name right, but she plays the love interest Lou in this. And she has like a very disjointed role in the sense that she's very big in the beginning, and then she disappears for a while. But I think she brought a lot of passion and a lot of humility to that character while still having its own story, which doesn't always happen with the girlfriend character. They just seem in service of the person that's in the lead. And what I really think is so great about this film is it's not ableist. And I think by enlisting so many people from the deaf community, it I think is a highlight of this moment, because that story where you're difficulty trying to explain someone feeling like they're losing their identity, it's a hard thing to do without making it seem like this is a tragic sentence. And they did it incredibly well.
Okay, excellent. So we're starting off with a bang. Sound of Metal is a good movie. So we'll move on to The Last Vermeer, a feature debut from producer turned director Dan Friedkin. And here's a clip.
Everything in here was stolen, and they put me in charge of finding out who took it and who sold it to the Nazis. This was just found in Goering's hidden collection.
It's a Vermeer.
This is your chance at redemption.
And yet I am sensing that perhaps it is you who needs redemption.
Christy, this is based on a true story and a book. What's the plot here?
So Claes Bang plays this Canadian a soldier in the Second World War. He's Dutch, but he's been fighting for Canada. And one thing that he is asked to do afterward is, you know, track down the origin of important pieces of art that have fallen into the Nazis' hands. And one of them is this incredible Vermeer. Of course, there are so few Vermeers that the ones that exist are incredibly valuable. So he needs to track down the origins of this painting. And that leads him to Guy Pearce's character, who also was a real guy, a sort of a failed artist, but like bon vivant, man about town, named Han von Meergren, who somehow had possession of this Vermeer. And so the question becomes, how did he have it? Was he using it to then sell to the Nazis to then funnel elsewhere? And his role in what happened with this painting is the mystery, and it is ever changing. It's kind of fascinating because in the last couple of years, Claes Bang has played lead roles in these films about art, between The Square and the Burnt Orange Heresy, and now this. There's sort of like a dashing leading man, yet kind of soulful artist about his presence. And so he can balance all of that. It's a very old-fashioned World War II picture in a lot of ways. It is very restrained, and the period detail is all just right. But Guy Pearce gives this incredibly showy, fun performance. It's flamboyant, it's funny, it's sexy, it's kind of impish. And so he kind of keeps you guessing throughout in a film that would ordinarily be kind of boring otherwise.
Yeah, I love Guy Pearce in almost everything. So he adds definitely a note of panache. Jacqueline, yes. What did you think?
So this one I actually saw pretty early on, and I really just centered in on the Guy Pearce performance. It is, like I would say, you're getting what you're expecting out of it. It is not going to, I think, wow the world. But there is a lot of, I think, thrilling aspects to the uncovering of the secret. And I do like how they really sort of prosecute the idea of really what is this man's intentions? Where was his heart? It's a very interesting way it was done.
All right. That's the last Vermeer time now. Of course, for a holiday movie. And let's talk about Lego Star Wars Holiday Special, not to be confused with the infamous 1978 Star Wars Holiday Special. Here's some from the trailer.
'Twas the night before Life Day in a galaxy far, far away.
Please be a cape. Please be a cape.
That's a wrap!
For Rey, adventure called, and she thought it would be fast.
Wow.
But there she found a key to the galaxy's past.
Oh, Master Luke, what are you doing?
Jacqueline, Lego, Star Wars, Christmas. Are they just basically printing money with this movie?
They're definitely printing money. Disney Plus knows how to make sure people stay on its platform. But this is actually, I would say, a bit of an inside joke with Star Wars fans as well, because it washes the horrible taste out of their mouths of the 1978 Star Wars special, which has lived in infamy for how bad it was, but yet was able to bring back all of the original cast members for the most part to come and participate in what is essentially a cable access version of what you would do for a Star Wars holiday special.
But maybe it's worth revisiting that one just to watch that train wreck.
It actually is, and I was just going to recommend that it is a great bookend, because the Lego's Holiday Special is what that was intending to be. It is pure fan service, a gift for Star Wars and Lego fans right before the holiday season. It brings back all of the characters that you love from the Star Wars universe, as well as some that maybe need some redemption. I mean, we have actually, you know, we have Anakin Skywalker, and then we also have folks like Lando Calrissian, and they're actually voiced by some of the original cast members. So Billy Dee Williams comes back to voice Lando. You have Rose Tico, voiced by Kelly Marie Tran. And of course, some of the bigger names. You're not seeing John Boyega, Adam Driver, and Daisy Ridley playing Rey, Finn, and Kylo Ren. But you definitely get some incredible voice actors doing that one. I think Helen Sadler does Rey, and she does an incredible job. It's funny, cute for the kids, and only 45 minutes.
Crucial. Okay. Christy, what did you think?
It comes at you so fast. There is so crammed with all kinds of nerdy Star Wars details. Now, if you love Star Wars, you will be in heaven. You're going to want to go back and rewatch it over and over again, not just because the lines come at you so fast and the jokes come at you so fast, but like, as is true with any Lego incarnation of anything, whether it's, you know, Batman or the Lego movie, there are so many little details, like in the characters, in the stuff in the background, that you're going to want to go back and rewatch it over and over again. I watched it with my son, who's 11, who's a huge Star Wars fan. We just got up this morning at 6 a.m. to watch The Mandalorian, of course. Mm-hmm. So we had a blast together. It is, yeah, and it's short.
All right. And really sit the kids in front of it. Just let them be silent. This is a gift for parents for 45 minutes of peace.
Amen. All right. Our final film today is part of a new series from director Steve McQueen. And the series is called Small Acts. And it retells pivotal moments of Black British history between the 60s and the 80s. And the first film, which we're going to talk about, is Mangrove. And here's a clip from the trailer.
There may be some who believe that they have been the victim of injustice at the hands of the police. Others who, like parasites, feed on these beliefs.
This attack on a Black establishment is not an isolated event. And today we are saying,
right, Jacqueline, what is Mangrove about?
Yes, so Mangrove is the first story, and this actually is centered in the 1970s, and it tells the story of the Mangrove Nine, which were a group of activists who were arrested after a series of raids in the Notting Hill neighborhood of London that was really primarily a West African and West Indian community, and how they sort of battled the police. It's essentially what we as a nation have been dealing with this year with the reckoning of racial justice. This was the spark of it in the 1970s in England, and it really talks about this moment in which this British establishment was essentially feeling the same sort of make America great again sentiment. They didn't understand how communities like Notting Hill could have this completely separate culture, and they really sort of attacked it. At the center of it is an incredible performance by Letitia Wright, of course, London native, and directed by Steve McQueen, who folks, of course, know from 12 Years a Slave, but also more recently Widows. And he said himself, this was a love letter to the Notting Hill and sort of the West Indian community, which in a lot of ways through gentrification and sort of mobilization has been deleted from a large part of the Notting Hill community. And so it's very, I think, it's a love letter to London culture and Black culture in that time frame.
Interesting. Christy, what did you think?
It's just a fascinating balance that Steve McQueen finds here, because he is primarily a visual artist. And so moments that might seem like ham-fisted or too feel-good or too rousing in a predictable way are gripping in his hands. Just the choice of where he will put the camera, the actor who plays Frank Critchlow, the restaurant owner at the center of all this, Sean Parks, gives just this powerhouse performance. But at one point, like he's thrown into a jail cell, and just the way Steve McQueen shoots that moment, and Mika Levy did the score for this and for all of these Small Axe movies. She also did Under the Skin. She does incredible experimental work. And so he will find ways to put you on edge, and it's unexpected over and over again in some material that might have seemed kind of pat and safe and feel good in somebody else's hands. Letitia Wright is incredible, so charismatic. She's so great as Shuri in the Black Panther movie, and really builds on that, just a total natural. And yeah, all these are great. I just watched Lovers Rock, which is part two of the Small Axe series, which comes out next week. And that's totally different and thrilling in its own way. So check them out.
Okay, cool. Where can we check those out?
Amazon,
yes.
All right. Well, this was a good outing. A couple of good movies to check out, so that's good.
I think we were 4 for 4 on good movies. Like, I think everyone's saying, like, this is a good weekend for movies no matter where you go.
I guess it's fall, so we should be expecting good movies.
Yeah. A good cross-section of stuff for everyone here.
Excellent. Christy Lemire writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. And Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes and co-host of the new podcast Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, dishes you can make from some of our favorite chefs to make this Thanksgiving memorable. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We've been talking a lot about how everyone's Thanksgiving is going to look different this year because of COVID. So why not make it taste different, too? Because if ever there was a year to buck tradition and make really whatever you want, this is it. And we are here to help you with a little inspiration for an unorthodox holiday feast. We're going to revisit some of the interviews we've done with chefs and cookbook authors and highlight some of their favorite recipes. First up is Alvin Kailan. He's the creator of the hit restaurant chain Egg Slut and now Amboy in Chinatown. One of his favorite things to eat any day of the year is a Filipino bread called pandesal. He talks about it in his cookbook, Amboy, Recipes from the Filipino-American Dream.
Yeah, it's a sweeter bun. It's I guess you can compare it to Hawaiian bread loosely. It's inspired by the Portuguese style dinner roll. And it's topped with breadcrumbs. And similarly to our, like the bun that we use here at Amboy, we use a similar flavor profile to pandesal, but it doesn't have like the crumb and the texture on the exterior of a bunny saw. We went with more of a traditional route. So we do sesame seed and poppy seed topped buns.
Hmm. You just wax rhapsodic about pandesal in your book. Like, the way you describe it, it sounds like if that were taken away from you, you would die.
Yeah. I mean, pandesal is a huge part of my pantry ever since I was a kid. You know, I some of my earliest memories with food is walking to Betsy's. It's a pandesal bakery up in East Hollywood or East Hollywood area. I remember going to the shop and smelling the bread. And as soon as my dad would receive the hot bag of buns, I would reach my hand in there and just tear one open and eat the inside. It's something that I love so much. And I think every Filipino and Filipino American can agree it's special.
With Chef Alvin Kailan of Egg Slut and Amboy. His cookbook is called Amboy, Recipes from the Filipino American Dream. Okay, so that's your bread. Now you need something to dip it into. And if you're like me, maybe in the early days of the pandemic, you panic bought a bunch of dried beans and those beans might still be sitting in your pantry somewhere. Yeah, they are. They are in mine. Well, Washington Post food and dining editor Joe Yonan has some ideas for how to fancy up those beans. We talked to him earlier this year for his cookbook, Cool Beans. He says one of his favorite ways to make beans is inspired by a Mexican chef named Lalo, who's famous for his cacahuate beans.
They're actually very simple to do at home, but I found the recipe so interesting because I've never really cooked beans this way. He basically cooks them very simply. You know, with just a little garlic. And then he makes a sofrito, you know, with tomatoes and chilies. And then he puts that back in the pot of beans, turns up the heat. They brings them to a boil, and you boil them for about 30 minutes, which to me just, when I first made it, I was thinking to myself, this is such a rough way to treat these beans, you know. It seemed really rough. I'm used to this gentle cooking, and what it did, of course, was it just concentrated that liquid and just made that flavor just completely take over the whole bowl of beans. And then you serve them with a simple pico de gallo.
Yum! That sounds delicious.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and the other thing that I'll mention about those beans is that, while I was eating them, I was thinking ahead to how I was going to... He had told me that he would give me the recipe, and I was thinking ahead to how I would interpret this for the home cook. And I was thinking, oh, well, you know, what bean am I going to tell people? I'm not going to tell people that they have to find these rare cacahuate beans from this little village in Mexico. And then when the beans came, I thought, oh, you know, these remind me of cranberry beans, which are also borlotti beans. And I thought, I'll try this with those beans when I get home. And then I started Googling around, and it turns out that cacahuate and cranberry and borlotti beans are just three different names for the exact same bean.
Washington Post food and dining editor Joe Yonan talking about his recipe for Lalo's cacahuate beans from his cookbook Cool Beans. Another pantry staple you might have is some pasta, which might not sound that exciting since a Thanksgiving feast is pretty much the opposite of a pantry staple dependent meal. But why not mix it up a bit and also scratch that travel itch you've been forced to suppress with a pasta recipe from Somalia. Hawa Hassan's book, In Bibi's Kitchen, is expected to land on a lot of best of year lists. It looks at the cuisines of 8 East African countries, including her home country of Somalia. She includes her mom's recipe for one of the country's signature pasta dishes. It's called sugo sukar. The key ingredient is a warm, savory and sweet spice mix called hawaj. So what is in the spice mix, and why is it so important to so many of these recipes?
First of all, it's a spice mix that is really reflective of the spice trade in the Indian Ocean. And it's the backbone of what Somali food is made with. Almost our rice dishes, our pastas, our stews, everything is often made with this spice. And the way I make mine, it's just with cinnamon stick, cumin, coriander, black peppercorn, cardamom pods, whole cloves, and then like a 2 tablespoons of turmeric at the end once I've toasted everything, grinded everything, then I throw in 2 spoons of turmeric.
Well, that raises the issue of all the different cultural influences on the food in Africa. Of course, the colonial influence in many countries. So in Somalia, you say that pasta is a staple in
right.
Somali food, which is interesting to me. I didn't think about that. But when you think of the Italian influence, I guess that makes sense.
Right. So the Italians colonized Somalia and Eritrea. So we've got some overlaying flavors along with Italy. I mean, our word for sauce for pasta sauce in Somali is sugo, which is an Italian word.
And how have you made it different?
I think what makes it Somali is just the spice. The Hawaj spice is what goes inside of it.
Uh-huh.
So you're not, it's not your typical pasta sauce in that it's just with like salt and pepper and maybe thyme or sage, but this is, it's warm. It's sweet and warm. And I think that's what ultimately makes it Somali.
So tell us about this recipe, Sugo Sukar.
So the recipe that is in the book is my mom's actually sauce, pasta sauce. So it's just pasta sauce with beef. Again, we talk about how the Italians colonized southern Somalia. I grew up in Mogadishu. I was born in Mogadishu. And so this recipe is really a homage to my mother and almost a love letter to Mogadishu. It's almost made exactly the same way that traditional pasta sauce is made, in that there's olive oil, there's garlic, there's bell peppers, there's, I used a red onion in it. You could use a white onion if you wanted to. And then what sets it apart really is the Hawaj spice. But everything else is the same in that, we use a canned tomato, a diced canned tomatoes, and then we use regular angel hair pasta.
That's cookbook author Hawa Hassan talking about her recipe for Sugo Sukar from her book In Bibi's Kitchen. And for the record, Hawa says you can throw her Hawaj spice blend on pretty much everything, and that could include your turkey. Okay, finally, every good feast needs a dessert. And we've talked a lot about pie already, so we're going to suggest a dessert that's totally different. And for that, we're going to revisit an interview I did in 2018 with LA chefs Ori Menashe and Genevieve Gurgis. They're the couple behind the popular restaurants Bestia and Bevel in downtown LA. And we had them on to talk about their cookbook with recipes from Bestia. In it, Genevieve shares the recipe for her persimmon mascarpone rice pudding. Persimmons are in season right now, but be warned, this recipe is for a home cook who's looking for a challenge or a project to pass the time. You have said that the mascarpone rice pudding is the dessert you're most proud of. Why?
Because when I came up with that, I think I had been doing pastries for like 2 months. And now that I look back, I'm surprised at myself. I'm actually proud that I can't even believe that I came up with something that complex that early, and I didn't even appreciate it at the time. I didn't realize what I had done, that it's definitely a cult favorite. I have people texting me right now saying they saw persimmons at the farmer's market, so they're anticipating that rice pudding will be back on soon. So it's really popular. It's I cook it like risotto style a bit, and it has saffron and bay leaf and vanilla and orange peel, and then it has mascarpone and creme fraiche, so you get a little of that dairy, lactic acid, and that tang, and you have, but the creamy cheesiness, and then the saffron, and I finish it with really, really ripe hachia persimmons and a hachia persimmon caramel, and then I use orange blossom oil that I got from Ori's parents, actually, And I use the orange blossom oil to make orange blossom pistachios and to finish it with a little floralness and a little bit of crunch. So,
yeah, I think I don't have risotto on the menu because I don't want to compete with her, her risotto rice pudding. Everyone's going to be like, your wife makes better risotto than you.
He's just using that as an excuse because he knows I love his risotto. He's just using that as an excuse not to give it to me.
That's Genevieve Gurgis and her husband, Ori Menashe, the couple behind Bestia and Bevel. The recipe for Genevieve's persimmon mascarpone rice pudding is in their cookbook, Bestia, Italian Recipes Created in the Heart of L.A. You can find all of the recipes we just talked about on our website at kcrw.com. Happy cooking! And that's it for our show this week. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Nihar Patel, and Kaylee Wells. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney, our managing producer. Amy Ta, our digital producer. Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards are our tireless technical directors. I'm Madeline Brand. Stay safe this weekend. Wear a mask. Stay inside. Thanks for listening. I'll see you Monday.